Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm hoping my co-host, Red Beckman, is going to be here with us shortly. Red, are you with us yet? Perhaps not. I'm sure he'll be calling in shortly. I believe our guest, though, am I excited about our guest tonight. I've been reading his book, The Illusion of Freedom, and it is a wonderful book that everyone should get a hold of. I would compare it on the line with 5,000 Year Leap and books like that. It could certainly be used for a textbook for teaching our kids. The author of that book is Mr. Martin Babbitts. Martin, are you there?
I am, Terry. I am indeed. Thank you.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds, and I'm trying to see if Red's with us yet. Red, are you on with us? Well, I'm sure he'll be
here
shortly. There he is. Red
I'm
Beckman,
here.
meet Mr. Martin Babbitts.
Yeah, well, I wonder if he was named as a replacement for Martin Luther.
not quite, Mr. Beckman, but I got to tell you, it's a great privilege to be on the program, and I've spoken with Terry previously, and I got to tell you, it's a great privilege to meet you online here and to get to speak with you and share this program with you. You're a great patriot.
Well, we are going to have a good program tonight because you're coming from the same place we are, I think. And I just, my mother was a Lutheran parochial school teacher when my father married her. And I was her first son, and so she had to name me Martin. That's why I wondered if you had gotten the name the way I got mine.
Oh, is that right? No, it's not quite. Not quite. I was actually born to a couple of real nice Jewish parents, and they wouldn't have thought along those lines. But I'm pleased to say that as a Christian today, it would have been a privilege to be named in that way. But I wound up with the same name. But no one calls me Red like you, so. I'm glad you can. That'll distinguish us.
Walter, one of the things we're going to do.
Excuse me, Terry?
What was that, Terry? Did somebody mute me?
No, you're okay.
I assume I'm okay, too. I just can't hear Terry.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, go ahead and talk. Terry dropped off. He'll be right back, I'm sure. He'll call back in. So if you guys can just, Red, take over. Thanks.
Yeah, well, Terry was telling me about your book, and of course I read a little of the bio that he had sent over, and you are an attorney, and which isn't a particular recommendation, but you know we all have found some very, very conscientious attorneys out there. And, you know, some of my best friends out there are attorneys. And, of course, one thing that is happening, of course, is so many of them are turning in their bar association membership. And Edwin Vieira, you're probably familiar with him.
Oh, very, very much so, and his wonderful writing, I most certainly am.
Yeah, and he's one that has recognized the corruption in the justice system for so long. And, I could name several. And, you know, these people, they've paid a high price, a lot of them, for taking the stand that they have. But anyway, it's good to have you on board. I'll have to read that book of yours.
Fred,
I'm back. I got dropped off the switchboard. Martin, one of the things we like to do at Walls in Our Minds is start with a prayer. I'm going to ask Red if you would open us up with a prayer, Red.
Yeah. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for this opportunity to visit and discuss the matters of great importance to us at this point in time. We are Your creation, and we're given the command to subdue and take dominion of this planet, and we have failed so miserably. And we just pray that You will forgive us for our failures, and we pray that You would help us so that we can discern the lie. When we hear the lie that we are able to have the Holy Spirit open our minds so that we can discern the lie. Walls in Our Minds is something, we've got that title on this program, and we just know that lies have built walls in the minds of the American people, and for that matter, the lives and the minds of the people all over this planet. And we just pray, O Lord, that You would give us the words to speak, give us the mental capacity to understand where we're at and what we must be doing to help You restore Your kingdom, bring Your kingdom to fruition. The founders of this country, their battle cry in the revolution was, "No king but Jesus." We need to get back to that point where we recognize that there's only one king out there, one king that can solve the problems that beset us. We thank Thee now for this opportunity and this privilege that we have of calling directly upon You. And we just pray that You'll bless as we lead on in this program, as we try to communicate with our fellow Americans. We thank Thee again for everything in Christ's name. Amen.
Amen.
Amen, Red. Well, Martin, just to give our folks, our listeners, a little bit of background, would you mind giving us a little idea of who Martin Babbitts is and kind of what brought you to writing The Illusion of Freedom?
Yes, Terry, I'd be happy to. As Red pointed out, and thankfully is not going to hold against me, I am an attorney, and I'd like to, during the course of the program, perhaps tie that into what tonight's topic may center on. But as an attorney, I've certainly experienced and seen some of the things that Red suggested. In terms of our judicial system, particularly in the means of their taking control invalidly of as sole arbiter of the Constitution. But all those things were not clear to me or to my discernment going through law school or spending time trying to earn a living over the past several years. And about 10 years ago, and this was a few years after my coming to faith in our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, I started to find that I was getting very curious about certain areas, specifically the Constitution. I've always been a political, had a great interest in political matters, and always thought myself to be a conservative, even from a very young age. But I started to wonder about the Constitution. One of the things in particular that was curious to me was this idea of the Supreme Court and the way they would twist and warp the Constitution in their rulings, and continue to, obviously, to this day. And I started trying to come up with some constructs or ways of how we might advocate constraining, restraining, or otherwise putting a noose around the Supreme Court and the federal court system. And I was operating under an assumption ingrained into me as an attorney and into most Americans, if not all, or just about all, that the Supreme Court is, in fact, the supreme and sole arbiter of the Constitution. That was very worrisome to me. And, you know, my focus, like a lot of conservatives or liberals, it seems to be on the Supreme Court. How can we get the right justices on the Supreme Court? How can we compel them to apply the Constitution as it really is in deciding cases? And or how can we limit the effects of their rulings such that they only apply to the parties in the case? That was kind of my focus. And then as I continued to read and explore and search for the truth, I very fortunately, approximately 10 years ago, came across a book that had been out of print for over 150 years, which thankfully now, over the past few years, has come into print again as some of these concepts are coming to light. The book, New Views of the Constitution of the United States, by John Taylor of Caroline, someone I had never heard of. But as soon as I started into this book, I knew that there was some revelation of truths, buried truths of our Constitution, our system of government, and the liberty it guarantees. And this took me in the direction that I continue on to this day, and it certainly led me to writing my book, The Illusion of Freedom. John Taylor of Caroline was probably the closest political advisor from an intellectual, conceptual standpoint of Thomas Jefferson's. They were certainly friends, contemporaries. They both lived close by in Virginia. And certainly there's a lot of historical evidence that John Taylor informed a lot of Jefferson's thinking, and certainly of like mind. But this led me to this wonderful concept of nullification, the concept that has been so tarred and feathered throughout our history books and revisionist history, and I came to the realization that that this, in my view, may be the great instrumentality of restoring liberty and restraining the federal government to its constitutional limitations. Certainly, I have become absolutely convinced that the federal government will never, ever restrain or reverse itself from the powers it's already usurped. I think that was proven during the Reagan years when that administration, which came in with wonderful idealistic concepts of reversing big government, failed miserably in that regard. So I see that concept, nullification, the assertion of the prerogative and reserve sovereignty of the states and their people in an active way as being the instrumentality of restoring liberty. And that was what my book was about. That was 7 years ago that I published my book. And at the time, this was a concept that was either completely unknown or thought of as some type of racist or slave owner type philosophy that had died out in the 1800s. Fortunately, over the past year or two, it has become resurrected, and these principles are now very much, I think, in the vision of a lot of great organizations and minds, and most importantly, in the state legislatures. The instrumentality by which we, the people of each state, exercise our reserve sovereignty, they are actually nullifying federal laws, and they are passing resolutions to resist and say that they will not give force and effect to unconstitutional federal rulings or laws or actions. So this is what I'm about, and this is you know, what I've been devoting myself to, and I'm just so excited to see that these principles are finding the light of day and are finding real practical use and application in many states over the past year or two.
Well, Red, you understand about being ahead of your time, don't you?
I guess I understand that. It's been hard for me to comprehend how this truth that Martin is talking about, how it was able, the establishment was able to push it down, cover it up, and of course it happened in the schools and the churches and the media. It was a full-blown attack on the Constitution and all that started there, you know, over 100 years ago. And so it's really music to my ears to hear him, you know, say what he is about this nullification. What I'm wondering is, are you thinking basically about the nullification by state legislatures and state governments using their authority to nullify federal statutes, or are you more comprehensive in the nullification, bringing in the juries and the grand juries? Because that has been my basic message now for well over 35 years.
Oh, it sure has, Red, and I'm well aware of it, and I am absolutely in line with that approach. I will tell you that my focus has been on state government, specifically state legislatures, for this reason. The United States Constitution guarantees in Article 4, Section 4, that a Republican form of government will be provided and guaranteed in every state, which means that we, the people of each state, me in New Jersey and you all out west a ways, in your respective states, you are sovereign and you exercise all sovereignty reserved, not delegated or, to the federal government. You exercise that sovereignty through your elected representatives, your state legislatures. Further, state legislators, like any other state or federal government official, take an oath to support the Constitution, which means that they are duty-bound to resist and treat an unconstitutional law or action of another branch or level of government as invalid, null, and void. So, yeah, that has been my focus, trying to resurrect the principle that at the level of our state governments, and particularly our state legislatures, as the instrumentality by which we exercise our sovereignty to nullify and resist, as is their duty, those federal statutes, rulings, executive actions that are unconstitutional and invalid. And I'm so pleased that that's been happening. There are several examples now over the past couple of years where that is happening. So that has been my focus, but I am aware, Red, of your what you've been advocating at the level of jury level, in the same type of concept, and I'm with you.
I've been discussing with a number of people around the country the situation with the Tea Parties, because they've got a lot of catching up to do. And at this point in time, most of them, I would say that 95% of them, and that's a wild guess, of course, on my part, but I wouldn't be surprised, but what 95% of those Tea Party people out there are convinced that the only way we can regain control of our government is with our vote on Election Day. That's I mean, that is a very serious problem that we have in this country, and this, of course, is something that I'm trying to remedy. And as I have been talking with some of these people, I say, now, wait a minute. Just put yourself back there in the day when the founders of this country, it was tax protesters that wrote the Declaration of Independence, and it was tax protesters that fought and won the War of Independence, and it was tax protesters that created the Constitution for the United States, and in December of 1791, they attached the Bill of Rights. And I say, if you put yourself back there in that time span with those people, you would find that their mental focus was on one thing, and that is limit the government with anything you can. That government is a problem, and it will be a problem if it isn't controlled. And to think that those people would trust politicians at that point in time enough to say, well, we'll give the people control with their vote on Election Day. They didn't do that, and
right,
because they had such a fear of government, runaway government, government without the proper controls, and of course they talked about separation of powers. And they talk about separation of powers in our schools, but they only talk about the separation of powers between the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government. That's the extent of it. They do not discuss the fact that the church is a separate power, and of course the Supreme Court tried to destroy that, but the church was to be a separate power as a check against government. The schools were to be a check. Every time you turn around, you run into it, that they put all these different checks in the system. And they put that check in the hands of the individual in the jury trial. And that gets it right down to our level. It gets us down to the lowest level. And the juror that hangs a jury with an 11-to-1 vote, that one juror has more power than the President of the United States of America. And that is not taught. This is what sovereignty is all about. So anyway,
yeah.
Sovereignty, it's, well, I, of course, in my presentations, I always talked about the pecking order. We were never taught the pecking order that God is at the top and we, the people, are right underneath him, under his law. And we're above the Constitution. We're above the Constitution. The president and the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government are all under the Constitution. But this is not taught. And we got our work cut out for us.
Yeah, well, Red, to follow on that a bit, your points are so well taken, and one of the problems, as you mentioned, separation of powers. You know, we look at someone, let's say like John Adams, who, you know, when he spoke of checks and balances and separation of powers, was only speaking of it at the horizontal level, that within the federal government, you were going to build into the Constitution the checks and balances between executive, legislative, and judicial. So that check is something that we are taught. We're also taught the check of election, that by our power at the ballot box, and also the fact that the three branches will check and balance each other. The problem is those two checks have proved to be wholly ineffective over the past 200 or so years, and for good reason, because once elected, if you know, official can do whatever they want, we all know that you know, unlimited power, whether you're elected or not, is going to become as unlimited as possible. And we also know that at the same branch of government, as we've seen throughout our history, the federal government, the three branches, will collude and have colluded and continue to collude with each other to enhance and build upon their combined or collective power. So the third check, at least within the constitutional framework, besides the checks you're mentioning, which are equally or more important, the church, schools, and so forth, but the third check, that vertical check, the states checking the federal government, that is an effective check. And that's the one, because it is effective, it hasn't been taught or ingrained. Nobody even thinks it exists. In fact, when it is talked about, it's marginalized as you know, something that the racist South, you know, drummed up as some kind of fiction about states' rights, and it all died with the Civil War and so forth. And yet, that's the effective check, because the state governments, the people running the state governments, they want power too. And when their power is set against the power of the federal government, that's taken away. Every time the federal government encroaches upon reserved powers, you're taking power away from state government, who are accountable to the people of each state. Now you have the opportunity for some real checking, because the people of each state, through their state representatives, can resist. They can say, hey, these powers are reserved to us. When you act, federal government, in a way that usurps or takes more power than you are providing in the Constitution, you're taking it directly from us. So it is a check that can work. Of course, that check has been so incredibly undermined and to a great extent destroyed by things like the income tax and the direct election of senators through a couple of amendments, as you point out, Red, were not even validly ratified. But this is an area, when you get past these two completely ineffective checks, election and the branches of federal government, you start digging into some checks that can really work, whether it's at the very micro level of a juror, or the power of our churches when they are actually not restricted wrongfully by the federal government, as they have been and continue to be and probably will be more so in the near future. Then we start seeing some opportunities to perhaps make a dent in restricting or reversing the incredible usurpation of power by the federal government that continues and continues on.
Red, you still there?
I'm here. I wouldn't miss this for anything. What is happening in Arizona is, you know, this is what would you say? This is a trial run. But every state in the union is watching that, and it's causing the legislators in every state in this union to excuse me, open their eyes and their ears and listen to the pros and the cons of what's happening. And from what I'm hearing, it sounds to me like most of the state legislatures around the country are going to side with the state of Arizona. And of course, I have my own ideas about what should happen. I'd like to see four or five people go in and file a Title 42 against that federal judge for damages, and file it under Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, so that it's a common law court, and I think it would become a real forum to bring out a lot of this stuff. And of course, I'd like to see him make that a class action lawsuit on behalf of all of the people of Arizona. I think there needs to be some real activism there on the part of the people of Arizona.
Absolutely, and I'm encouraged that at the state government level, there's been very strong statements that federal ruling is not something that they're going to give credence to, that they're going forward with their law. And so, you know, Red, you and I are kind of looking at the opportunities for resistance and dealing with unconstitutional federal government action in kind of from differing perspectives, but really the same principle of the power and authority nullification, which, as you say, you know, ultimately rests with the people. And you know, the way our system was established, our true system was established, was obviously to maximize that authority and that sovereignty, popular sovereignty, a concept that was really unknown until our founding. The idea that sovereignty does not reside in a king who is somehow the representative of God in their country or something like that. Arizona is a wonderful testing ground, and you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the concerns maybe people have is, hey, anytime a state stands up to the federal government, the government's going to roll in the tanks, which, you know, in certain cases they might or might not. But so far, they have not. And, you know, there have been other examples. The Real ID Act passed a few years ago, where another unfunded federal mandate where states were going to be responsible for this new universal ID. You know, maybe some people call it the Mark of the Beast Act because it was taking, you know, the Social Security number and life and everything to the next level. The states, 20-some-odd states, said, hey, we are not going to enforce or give any credibility to this law. It's an unfunded federal mandate that's unconstitutional. And as a result, although the federal government did not rescind or revoke the law, they basically ignored it, and it's a dead letter now as a result of resistance at the state level, really nullification. So what's happening in Arizona is fantastic, and I'm actually encouraged, and I was kind of glad to see that federal ruling, because it is another opportunity to, in a very public way, resist and demonstrate that the federal government is not all supreme, that they are restricted to their enumerated powers, and that Arizona, as a sovereign state with a duty to their people, have a duty, authority, and sovereignty that they exercise on behalf of their own people to protect their people within, you know, their reserved power. So it's really a wonderful laboratory experiment, as you say, Red, that's going on down there, and I'm very encouraged by the way it's been moving forward.
One of the reasons why I would like to see that judge sued, there's something that has been pretty much misunderstood and not recognized. I sued a federal judge in Montana. I'm a Montanan, basically. I'll always be a Montanan, but I'm living in Washington State right now. I sued the chief federal judge in the Montana district, and I said that he was making findings of fact and conclusions of law in favor of the government, and that he had a very serious conflict of interest. What I had done, I had filed three different actions in federal court having to do with the Internal Revenue Service, and all three of the cases on motion of the Justice Department were summarily dismissed by the federal judge without a hearing even. And so that's, and in each case, I demanded a jury trial. And the judge, you know, he had a serious conflict of interest. He was an attorney. He had been a congressman from Montana until Richard Nixon appointed him to the federal bench. And he had a serious conflict of interest, as does the federal judge that made the ruling in Arizona. She is a federal employee. She is going to rule in favor of the federal government because she is denied impartiality because of her conflict of interest, her employer. And so the decision as to whether that law is a valid law and should be enforced rests with the people in the state of Arizona, not with a federal judge. And that's the area that I, you probably hadn't heard of that one, going at it from that angle. But I think that this, you see, brings it down to the level of the people, you know, on the street, that they are the ones who should make this decision. They should be given both sides of the argument and let them make their decision. And so, you know, if I was getting in the act down there, I'd be going after that federal judge for her conflict of interest. I would cite her code of ethics, where conflicts of interest are addressed. And of course, we're having a lot of interesting things happening in the tax courts and that type of thing, using the same argument. Basically, the tax courts aren't courts at all. They're just government steamrollers, and they'll roll right over you. But the judge in the tax court, there's no constitutional due process in tax court. You can't get a jury. And the judge makes all finding of fact and conclusions of law. Well, he's got a serious conflict of interest because he's a government employee. So this is an area that that I've been working on, and needless to say, that case where I went after the federal judge, that case was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court in August of '96, and they haven't heard it yet to this day, and they never will.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, Red, that's one of the things, and we both see the problems in our court system, both structurally and also, you know, as a practical matter, you know, not getting due process. Part of it is, as you say, in the tax court, and by the way, a lot of my work as an attorney has been in the tax area, but the tax court or any federal court, when determining an issue, particularly let's say the Supreme Court or any federal court, like the federal district court that just issued that unconstitutional ruling that they had no authority over on the gay marriage law in California.
California.
You know, you're talking about judges who are, first of all, as we know, appointed for life on quote-unquote good behavior. So they have a life tenure. They have total non-accountability to anyone, but more importantly, they are appointed or hired and paid by the federal government, which is one of the parties in every action that they rule on, which is, you know, it's ridiculous. Sometimes I say if Americans cared as much about liberty as they did football, then we'd be a lot better off. And the reason I say that is, let's just imagine Terry, the Denver Broncos are out there, and out by me we got the Philadelphia Eagles. So if the Eagles and Broncos are playing a football game, let's say it's the Super Bowl, but the Eagles get to hire and pay the referees for the game, and those referees can interpret and construct and construe the rules and even modify them, you know, for the common good. You know, there'd be blood in the streets. You know, the Broncos fans would be rioting.
That actually happened, didn't it?
Yeah, I think. So, you know, it's really it's crazy, and that's one of the reasons, Red, why as an attorney looking at the system and as frustrating as it is, I look at another means of recourse as perhaps being, you know, our state legislatures. As an example, with the federal judge ruling in Arizona, or let's take that recent federal judicial ruling at the federal district court in California, which overturned the people of California very decisively made a decision in an area entirely reserved to the people of the state of California to decide, which is, you know, whether or not, you know, marriage is one man and one woman. They made the decision. The federal district court, you know, stepped in to an area they have no authority over and, you know, struck down the decision of the sovereign people. That's an area where I believe the California state legislature has a duty to issue a resolution saying that the federal ruling in that case is completely null and void and will have no force or effect in the state of California. Same could occur and maybe should occur in Arizona with respect to that ruling. I remember, you two may remember the decision in Lawrence versus Texas a few years ago. Texas had a sodomy law on the books, which at any time the people acting through their state legislature in Texas could revoke, but they hadn't. And the United States Supreme Court stepped in and claimed that that particular behavior was a fundamental constitutional right and struck down that law, which, you know, was only available to be struck down by the people of Texas acting through their representatives. This is an area clearly reserved to the states and their people. So these are areas where, in addition to judicial action in the courts, as Red has been involved in so, you know, wonderfully and in such a committed way over these decades, I view, you know, this other instrumentality as an opportunity to accomplish something. And, you know, the precedent for resistance, nullification at the level of our state legislatures derives from two reasonably impressive men when we talk about the United States Constitution, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, who authored the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions way back in 1798. And people are actually starting to hear about these Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. Nobody had heard of them, but now the last couple of years, it's getting out there into the consciousness of some of the people, which is wonderful. And what's so great about that is the example that those resolutions were in response to perhaps the most tyrannical law passed in the history of our federal government. It was a sedition law which said, in so many words, that criticism of the president or Congress was a jailable offense. And opponents of the would-be King John Adams and his Federalist Congress, opponents in state legislatures and state courts, in the press, were getting thrown in jail for criticizing the federal government, an obscene attack on the First Amendment. And Jefferson and Madison's response was to draft resolutions that were introduced and passed in the Virginia and Kentucky legislature saying, hey, this law is clearly unconstitutional, and it is null and void and of no force or effect. We are duty-bound as the representatives of our people to give this law no force or effect in our state. And that example has been buried and forgotten and warped into this idea that the idea that states' rights is not a constitutional prerogative and privilege of the people of each state, but rather a racist slave owner kind of a theory that was shot down by the Civil War. So I'm just so excited because this is another, in my view, another means and opportunity for effective resistance of federal tyranny. You know, one of the things, Red, you and I have been talking about is that our legal system and some of the issues. One of the things, one of the reasons I believe we've gone down the course we have is because of the way we train our future lawyers and future judges. You know, I went to law school, and I can tell you that in my law school and every law school, for the most part, if not maybe there's one exception or two exceptions in our country, but every law school, more or less, when you take constitutional law as your law student, you go in and you figure, well, this is a course on the U.S. Constitution. You're going to read the Constitution, but you don't. Not once are you asked to read the United States Constitution. You are immediately given a textbook, and a very thick textbook that's filled with Supreme Court opinions. And your professor tells you that the Constitution is something that the Supreme Court breathes life into, that they're, through their cases and their opinions, the Supreme Court determines what the Constitution means and what the Constitution is, and that the Supreme Court is the unilateral arbiter and the supreme arbiter of the Constitution and its meaning, and that the people can never understand what the Constitution means or says. It has to be interpreted. It has to change with the times. We have to consult societal trends and sociological studies and international law to understand and breathe new life into the Constitution. This is what we're conditioned as aspiring lawyers and judges. This is what we come to accept. As I said, for many, many years as an attorney, I accepted that, and I was so frustrated because, as you've seen, Red, in our legal system, to rely on judges to effectively interpret and apply the Constitution, particularly federal judges, is somewhat of a joke. So that's the problem. In my view, or certainly a part of the problem, is that our legal system is filled with people who have been trained to accept federal supremacy, and particularly federal judicial supremacy, as being a constitutional principle. And certainly attorneys and judges, in large part, educate the people about, what the Constitution is, what our system is all about. So it's such an ingrained, an invalid, ingrained fiction that is so difficult to overcome. Because when I have conversations with fellow attorneys, they're operating from a paradigm that the Supreme Court and the supreme is the unilateral instrumentality by which to interpret and apply the Constitution. And what can be so depressing is that even those judges who do believe in strict construction of the Constitution, most of them, if not all of them, also believe in federal judicial supremacy. I had the opportunity to talk to Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, and many people love him. Uncle Tony, a strict constructionist, and so forth. But when I asked him about the authority and duty of other branches of government to nullify unconstitutional laws, just like the Supreme Court does, he absolutely disagreed with me. So this is the problem and the issue. I think it's one of education bringing these matters to light. So I have seen a lot of what's happening within the legal system, and challenges and at the federal court level, and suing justices, as you suggest here, Red, which I think is a wonderful idea, and taking matters to the Supreme Court or whatever it might be, but they so often end in futility. And looking at some of the work and things that you've done in the federal tax area, it can be so frustrating to me. When I read the history of your involvement in that, and the way the federal government just, glosses over and pushes aside any truth in terms of, even central matters, like was the 16th Amendment even validly ratified? So this is why this area has become such a source of encouragement and interest to me over the past decade or so.
I had a phone call one day from an attorney he had a tax problem. And he more or less told me what his tax problem was. And so I told him, I said, well, I can tell you the best remedy, but you're not going to accept my ideas. But I will tell you what the best remedy for this problem is. He wanted to hear it, and so I said, well, number one, you've got to pull out your, turn in your, excuse me, turn in your Bar Association membership and operate in, you know, persona, you know, in his own being, in his own person. Anyway, he was all ears, of course. I could tell he was trying to figure out where I was going. But anyway, I said, if you do that, then you can go into federal court with the Title 42. These people are causing you to lose sleep. They're causing you to, you know, to have mental problems that you don't need. They're interfering basically with your livelihood and such. And the place to get this settled is in a common law court as per Rule 38 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And I said, you are familiar with the Seventh Amendment, aren't you? And, he kind of stuttered a bit. And he'd been practicing law, he told me, for about 20 years. And so right away I could tell that he had no familiarity with the Seventh Amendment, whatever. And so I said, you've surely got a copy of the Bill of Rights handy someplace. And I said, I've got one in front of me. And I don't remember whether he read it or I read it, the Seventh Amendment. And I said, well, didn't they teach you something about the Seventh Amendment in law school? And he said, no. He said, in law school, we spent days and weeks almost on the First Amendment and the Fourth and the Fifth, the darlings of the civil libertarians. He said, we spent a lot of time and read a lot of case law on those particular amendments. And I said, well, the Seventh Amendment is the most important of the 10 articles of the Bill of Rights. The Seventh is by far and away the most important of all. Well, that kind of blew him away. And and so I said, well, what did they teach you? Well, while I was talking to him, he reached up on his bookshelf and got his textbook, one of his textbooks down and from law school and looked it up, and it's all it said about the Seventh Amendment was this. The Seventh Amendment secures your right to a jury trial you're secured a right to a jury trial in a civil matter. That's all they taught him in law school. Now,
sure.
I came to the conclusion quite some years back that the legal profession has done everything they can to bury or drop the Seventh Amendment through the cracks. I've asked many an attorney, what is the highest court of our land? And they look like at me like I'm an idiot. Everybody knows the Supreme Court is the highest court in the land. And I say, no, that's not. The Supreme Court is not the highest court in the land. And I have to quote the Seventh Amendment to them, where it says, no fact tried by a jury may be reexamined by any court in the land. If you have a common law jury trial and you have a verdict from that common law jury, the Supreme Court can't touch it. And And the problem is the Supreme Court, you see, that is made up of nine lawyers who are nine government agents. They are agents of the federal government because the federal government is their paymaster. That's where they get their pay. And that's who they are going to rule in favor of the federal government almost without exception. And so, you see, that attorney back there, I don't know what he ever did. He never called me back. whether he just decided he better go back and start studying the law a little bit. And of course, I've worked with attorneys, and I had one back in Montana that really did a good job for me. And I really appreciated him. And he was a graduate of Columbia University. And I used to tell him, I say, Rob, go back to Columbia University and demand your money back. Because they didn't teach you anything you really should have known. And he never disagreed with me.
Yeah. It's absolutely right. I mean, the amendments, certainly the Seventh is not focused on, and even those amendments that are, you know, focused on are done so in a way that, you know, first of all, you know, if you're only exposed to case law of the Supreme Court as the means of understanding the Constitution, you're going to have a warped viewpoint. There was a case in 1958 where finally the Supreme Court came out and said, you know, we are the, you know, we are superior. We are the Constitution. We're above the Constitution because we can change it. We can interpret it. I mean, they were bold enough to say that, and you know, they choose the right cases to do it. That case involved I'm trying to remember the title of the case, but it involved you know, integration of the schools. It was a politically charged issue. President Eisenhower had already decided he was going to use federal troops to enforce that, so they knew they could say it in that context, and they wouldn't get any resistance from the president or Congress, because the case itself was such a political hot potato. So they used that as their forum to announce boldly, to declare that they are in fact the supreme expositor of the Constitution. They never claimed it; they'd always acted as if. But from that point on, 1958 on, then you get such even grosser distortions and obscene attacks on the Constitution. Prayer in school shot down as being unconstitutional. Separation of church and state just warped to the most incredible level. Then you get things like right of privacy being found to be in the penumbras or shadows of the Constitution, leading ultimately to Roe v. Wade and a constitutional right to abortion, things of that nature. So, you know, you're right, Red. I mean, I can vouch for that. You know, I went to, you know, quote-unquote, an Ivy League law school as well down in Philadelphia. And I tell you, you know, in many ways, you should get your money back because the legal positivist view, you know, that judges and lawyers can change the world and, you know, we're going to be all powerful. And, you get drunk with the idea that you're going to be in charge and you know what's best for the people and that you're going to be the elite and the Constitution is just a pliable old, you know, piece of parchment that you're going to shape. It's as if, you know, the Constitution is a, you know, as Jefferson said, turned into blank sheets of paper that the judges and particularly the so-called highest court of the land write and rewrite in their own discretion as they see fit. And, you know, that's why it's so frustrating, I think, for a lot of people who spend so much time saying, we got to get the right people on the Supreme Court. So let's give a hello to Justice Kagan and welcome to her.
Yeah.
Boy, she really, I mean, that's a doozy. But so that's the problem. You're right. I think we have to look at the institutions. You mentioned schools. Well, one area of our schools that really has warped our understanding of what our constitutional system and republic is all about are our law schools. And these are the people who, you know, aspire for the power. I mean, I look at a guy like Antonin Scalia, who, you know, even someone like that, we say, boy, if we could have nine Scalias on the court, we'd be in great shape. But the problem is that they still, people like him, anyone who aspires to be on the Supreme Court views that as the opportunity, you know, that they have the answers and that they're right, regardless of where they stand on the, you know, political ideology, you know, framework, whether they're Kagan or Scalia.
Martin, we're coming up to a break here. I hope we can continue this in the next hour if you're going to be with us. I don't know where Terry's at, but
Red, are you hearing me?
I hear you now.
Okay, good. I've been in and out. I have had a live mic. We are going to take a break. Marty, when we come back, I'm going to throw some things at you right now, and maybe Janet will wait about a minute before she hits the music. We're getting questions in our chat about common law versus admiralty, and I know that a lot of our patriots have come to the conclusion that all the courts are now under admiralty, which I don't buy into that thinking at all. But the question is, do you have to go through admiralty to get to common law? And I know the answer to that, but I'd like for you and Red to discuss that so that our listeners can get clear on it. So we will be back in just a couple of minutes. Martin, you going to be able to hang in with us a little longer?
I will hang in, Terry. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. We'll be back with Walls in Our Minds in just a couple of minutes. That was a great song. This is Terry Dodd, and this is Walls in Our Minds. I'm here with my co-host, Red Beckman, and we have a wonderful guest tonight, Mr. Martin Babbitts, the author of The Illusion of Freedom, How to Restore the Constitution and Reclaim Liberty Now. Martin, you still with us?
I am, Terry. Thank you.
You know, I've gotten compliments about you having such a great radio voice.
Well, you know what they say, if you have a face for radio. I'm sure that's not the case for you two, but perhaps it is for me. But that's a great thing to hear. I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, before you leave tonight, I hope you get an opportunity to talk a little more about the 10th Amendment Center, because I really want to – I'm anxious to hear about that myself. I know you're the New Jersey State Coordinator for the 10th Amendment Center, and I'm kind of excited to hear about that. But can you address the questions that I ask about common law and the Admiralty Court? I know that what I've read about Scalia, by the way, was that even though he doesn't adhere to this living constitution stuff about he holds to original intent, but it seems that he refuses to really dig into common law to interpret what the original intent was.
That's a great point, and you know I probably Justice Scalia may not be the best example because he does have an interesting slant on the idea of strict construction, something he calls originalism. If for any of those of our listeners who are interested, Justice Scalia wrote a pretty short book called A Matter of Interpretation, where he lays out his concept or notion of originalism. He views that the four corners of the statute itself is where you can find, you know, the actual intent or original intent, that you don't look to, you know, common law gloss or the legislative history or things of that nature, which, you know, is somewhat troublesome to me because, you know, from my perspective, I look at the Constitution and I think I look at the legislative history of the Constitution as, you know, the record of the Constitutional Convention as being so incredibly telling as to what, you know, is meant in our text of the Constitution. So you're right, that is something that's he's a little bit different from the, you know, let's say typical strict construction justice, which certainly is far preferable to anything in the living Constitution area of things. Yeah, you're right, he has a different slant on things. I will tell you, what I'd like to do, Terry, on the common law and admiralty question, is I'm going to at least initially defer to you and Red, because I know you have some thoughts on that. And I have to confess I'm not an expert in that area. I have some thoughts, but I'd love to hear from you two first, and then I'll chip in as anything that maybe I could add to the discussion on that.
Red, you want to go first?
Oh, I was hoping to hear his view, and I usually come up with a view after I hear the other side. The common law, basically, you know, I go back to the book of Genesis in our Holy Bible, and I read in there, right in the very early part of it, that God told Adam and Eve, he said, I want you to subdue and take dominion of this planet. And I've thought about it so many times, in fact, I have spoke about it, how that if we the people on this planet, if we had enforced the Ten Commandments on this planet, if we had set up governmental systems that provided the format and such for people to administer and enforce the Ten Commandments, we could have had orderly societies all over this planet. We would have had there wouldn't have been any room for disorder. The Ten Commandments are basically the basis upon which common law, as far as I'm concerned, where it comes from. And this is something that we should have learned at our mother's knee. We should have learned it in Sunday school. We should have learned it in our public education. We should have had special instructions on this type of thing. Today, there are patriots out there that say, well, the common law, you can't get a common law court. Well, they haven't gone and checked the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure that provide for a Seventh Amendment common law court in Rule 38. And so it's still there. Basically, that's what I had filed in 1993 and was able to carry that all the way through. And, of course, I intend at some point here, if my health lets me do it, bring up that 16th Amendment ratification thing in a common law court. Because what we have experienced in our 25 years, the Law That Never Was, Volume 1, came off the press in April of 1985. That's 25 years ago. And the federal judges, acting as government agents, have absolutely obstructed justice to the point that we have never been able to bring it into an actual court of law and have a jury determine the facts of the case. And so I'm kind of hoping that the good Lord gives me the time and the energy to do this, because I think that we now know how to, you might say, neutralize the federal judges in the courts to keep them from interfering and injecting, statutes and administrative procedures are really a major problem for the American people today. And what I have more or less discovered is that when you attack these things with the common law, you can literally, take administrative law and throw it in the trash because it doesn't apply in the common law, and because all administrative procedures are basically written by government agents the agencies that were given the responsibility of enforcing these laws passed by the Congress. They write most of the rules and the regulations themselves, and so they're not law in that respect. So anyway, I'm kind of getting astray here a little bit perhaps, but the common law, if we just study the Ten Commandments, we will discover that there is the guidelines to create an orderly society. In just ten laws, ten different laws that are there, and there's other principles involved that come along, but that's my idea of it. Terry, I don't know what your idea is, but I'd like to hear it.
Well, Red, if you're represented by an attorney, how can you get into common law if you're represented?
You can't.
Okay, so you have to go without representation. To say pro se is wrong too, because that means you're
absolutely
representing yourself.
Yes.
So it's not pro se, and I forget the other term.
Pro per.
It really is going. Yes.
Pro
okay.
per. Pro persona. In your own person. And that's the way it should be, because no one knows your side of a controversy like you do. And bar association attorneys, for the most part, their obligation is to maintain the authority of the court and such. And so In a common law action, the judge is there on the bench. He sits there. He needs to be there. He needs to be there to help maintain the order of the court, of course. But if either side have a question that they would like to ask the judge for his opinion, he can give his opinion of the law. He can give his opinion, but he has to make sure that the jury understands his position, that he's not, you know, he's not able to make findings of fact or conclusions of law, because the jury has that responsibility. And so, anyway, I think that we're going to start seeing some common law cases coming up in the not-too-distant future that are going to get very, very interesting. And so it needs to happen, and I think it will. So, Terry, it's back to you.
Okay. I'm going to throw out some things, and then I'll let the lawyer try to straighten this out, because I'll probably get this all up. I'll probably get this wrong, but at any rate, you know, you've got various types of courts, and what we're talking about here is a Pettit court situation. We're talking about not a grand jury situation. That we're talking about common law here. That's a different subject. We're talking about a Pettit situation where there is a judge, and it's an official court of law, where you can. Admiralty basically is the law of the sea, and I know that it enters into a lot of insurance situations, for example. People get the impression that it might be an admiralty court because they see a flag with a gold fringe on it, which is a flag of war or also represents admiralty. And in some cases, they may be correct. But the question here is, how do you get into a common law condition? Well, the way you do that is by just like Red said, and that is by not being represented, but going in pro persona, in your own person. If you do not go through one of these other courts to get to anything, if you enter into a situation, whether it's a corporate situation or a municipal situation, or you know, you can describe others, Marty, what you call them. But if you go and you enter into any of those other kind of courts, well, then you're giving them jurisdiction as whatever they're treating you as. They may be treating you as a corporate entity. So, you know, that's what I know about it. I do know that it's very, very difficult to pin a judge down to find out or get him to admit what capacity he is there serving in. All of the cases that I know of where the person has gone in, been pro persona and demanded to know what capacity the judge is serving in, the judge has refused to give an answer and has either gone ahead and forced an entry of a plea or has in some cases actually dismissed the cases. So I do not know of a case where anyone has confronted the judge about his official capacity and gotten an answer.
Yeah, and it doesn't happen. I agree with that you're not going to get that answer when you confront it. You won't get an answer. You know, when we talk about common law, I'd like to mention two quick points and then ask you two gentlemen to perhaps respond. I want to follow on that thread from Red regarding the Ten Commandments. Two quick things. One is that James Madison, you know, known as the father of our Constitution, you know, was quoted as saying, "This Constitution has no chance of working, and this system, this constitutional republic with popular sovereignty, has no possible chance of survival without a people committed to the Ten Commandments as their standard for living." And really, Red's absolutely right. I think throughout histories, particularly Judeo-Christian history, the Ten Commandments have been the foundation of what we call common law. Anything that makes sense can be derived or traced back to the Ten Commandments. You know, stealing, lying, murder, etc. So when you see some of these, particularly at the federal level, laws that are just so far outside of that aspect of things, it really falls outside of the scope of legitimate law, in my view. So I do agree with Red there. The other thing is when we talk about common law, I think it's an important point to discuss in this context is whether there's such a thing as federal common law. Clearly, there's state common law because there were, you know, long before we had a federal government, we had states and we also had colonies before that that were issuing judicial rulings under, you know, common law precepts and developing common law. And that's the English system that's been around for centuries, but certainly the states had it and continue to have it. The question I have is whether there is such a thing as federal common law, or is the federal government, in terms of its ability to develop, enforce, or have laws, limited to the Constitution and any congressional laws that can be issued, you know, or enacted by Congress under their enumerated powers. I'm of a mind that, you know, federal common law is not something that really is legitimate or valid, but rather, you know, any United States or federal laws can only be those statutes passed by Congress as applied legitimately by federal courts. But I'd love to hear, you know, you two respond to that. I think it really gets at the heart of the issue that we've been discussing the past few minutes.
Well, Red already addressed the Seventh Amendment, and that applies on a federal level. So there's no question that if the federal government brings you into a federal court and you make a Seventh Amendment demand on a pro persona basis and declare that judge to be a government agent and demand that he remove himself from making judgments of matter of law because he is not capable of being impartial on an issue where they're claiming that you owe them more than $25, then they have to put you into a common law grand jury situation and provide a jury of your peers under common law. So that would be a federal condition. Correct,
yeah.
Red?
According to the rules of the common law. The question is, what is, you know, how do we decipher what the common law is under the Seventh Amendment? And I certainly defer to Red. Red is maybe the most accomplished Seventh Amendment person we have in our country. So I defer to Red on that. When we talk about the Seventh Amendment and the common law, as it's phrased in that, what are we talking about? I'd love to hear from Red on that.
Well, the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, those three are they're the sweethearts of the civil libertarians, the ACLU and all those kind. And of course, they never address the Seventh. But when you look at those three, the First Amendment, of course, has the five clauses, and there is no enforcement. There is no enforcement in the First Amendment to enforce the freedom of religion or speech or press or freedom to assemble or freedom to petition for redress of grievances. There's no enforcement in the Fourth Amendment, illegal searches and seizures, the basic thing. And, of course, the Fifth Amendment, the same thing. The Seventh, and I think the founders put the Seventh Amendment there with that number seven because the number seven is God's number. And so I think the Seventh Amendment was put there as the most important of all of the 10 articles of the Bill of Rights. They were put there it was put there so that, you know, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights could be enforced by the people. It was the people that were responsible for the enforcement of the First Amendment. It was it's the people, you see, you know, it comes down to the sovereignty. Let me bring up the pecking order again. And I've used that pecking order over and over again on a good many television programs. You know, putting God at the top and God's law at the top, and then we the people are directly under our Creator, and then of course the Constitution is below we the people. We the people created that Constitution. We the people are the creators of the supreme law of this land. And, of course, that's the supreme law governing government. It's not God's law is supreme over all. But if you really think about this, how vital it is that we keep we the people up here above the Constitution in the order of authority. You know, in the military, you'd have nothing but chaos if you didn't have an order of authority. You've got the order of authority in all corporations, and you have to have an order of authority. This is something that's absolutely one of the most vital things about a society. To have an orderly society, you must have this order of authority. And so the people themselves are the enforcers of the Bill of Rights. They're the enforcers of the Constitution because of their sovereign position over the Constitution, as creators of that Constitution, and the fact that the Constitution is the creator of the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government. And, you know, our judges in our courts, and particularly the U.S. Supreme Court, they have put themselves, they have bootstrapped themselves up to the point where they are over God's law at this point in time. And until we can put them back under the law, we will continue to have major, major, major problems in this country. Problems of all kinds, because they've got to come back under the law. When the Constitution was formed, there had been about 40-odd times under Magna Carta, which came into power and into effect in 1215 A.D., between 1215 and 1776, there was over 40 times where the people of England had to bring the government back under the law. And you see, that's what our War of Independence was all about. King George, you either come back and come back under the law. We were part of the British Empire. It was our government that we were fighting in the War of Independence. And the founders were basically telling King George, you bring yourself back, put yourself back under the law, and there won't be a battle. There won't be a war. But King George, of course, didn't see it that way, and so the War of Independence settled the issue, at least temporary. And I think that Well, I probably haven't addressed it as I should, but I think it's all information that goes together and helps form a picture of what we were supposed to do and what we were what we should be. Terry, can you make sense or clarify what I have said here?
Well, I think in order to really get a clear picture of this, we need to come back to the issue of the people having a higher vote as a juror, especially a petit juror, also a common law, actually also as a grand juror. They have the right to judge the law as a juror. And the judges that have given instructions where they have said, you have the right to judge the facts of the case, but I will instruct you on the law, they are, in fact, in violation of the Constitution, just like that judge, the Supreme Court judge back in 1800. What was his name, Red?
You're thinking of...
the one that was impeached.
Yeah, yeah. My goodness. And I know it so well.
You're talking about...
Supreme,
Chase?
Yes. Chase. Samuel Chase, thank you.
Back in the early 1800s.
Right. Back then, even the Supreme Court used juries. And that Samuel Chase gave instructions to a jury for the Supreme Court that they were not to judge the law, but just the facts of the case. And he was impeached for that. He was almost thrown out for that.
There was articles of impeachment passed by the House, but he saved himself from impeachment in the Senate because he spoke up in his testimony before the Senate, and he said, everybody knows that the jury has the right to judge the law as well as the facts in a controversy. He said, everybody knows, and see, right there is a key. We don't have but a very, very small, minority that know that they have the right to judge the law as well as the facts in a case.
So a central part of common law, one of them, is getting it out of the hands of a judge in making that decision, because in common law, it's the common people who make that decision. But also, and you can address this more, Marty, because I'm sure you can probably explain this better than me, but common law came out of the law that was being practiced at the time, the founding of our country. They relied more on common law simply because it was accepted practices at the time. It wasn't like a rules of procedure unless you went to, like law of nations or natural law, things like that were applicable. Went back to the Magna Carta even. So it really applies to those things that were accepted and amongst the people as being what the law was, and they having a jury where the common people decided what was right and what was wrong.
No, that's absolutely right, Terry. I mean the idea of common law. Something I had developed over hundreds of years in England, and then continued in the colonies and then in states, and obviously continues to this day, is the concept that at the level and quite frequently, especially in older periods of time, not just at the court level but at the jury level, decisions becoming accepted customs, and in many ways the people directly making a law through juries and such. That's really where much of common law comes from. Decisions at the level of the people through juries and trials, as opposed to judge-made law when there is no jury, as Red points out. Whether it's the tax court or a lot of these administrative courts where there is no jury, or the appellate level where let's say the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, issues a ruling, and that becomes the law of the land. you know, that's a whole different type of notion and one that's become warped. And, you know, a big part of things is that the government, in their desire and lust for power and control, have really converted our country to, and that's why the point I was trying to get at not very well a few minutes back, you know, to a law of statutes and codes. You know, every area of the law now you see this push toward model codes, whether it's in the area of torts, you know, injury or that type of thing, or contracts, or even procedure, civil and criminal procedure. Everything is now based on statutory codes, and many of which are model codes, which all the states adopt, so that everyone has a uniform law, you know, that's at the government level passed, as opposed to, you know, trying to really crowd out or take away room for law made by the people through juries and, you know, common accepted you know, development of precedents at the level of jury trial. So, you know, the system has, you know, in all areas, in this area of common law and, you know, kind of the government takeover of law through, you know, the statutory law as opposed to common law, is just one of the many areas where the, you know, establishment of government supremacy, particularly federal government supremacy, has become prevalent. So I think that Red and the focus of his work and advocacy with respect to the Seventh Amendment is so well taken. Because, again, going back to, you know, our law schools, we'll learn about the Seventh Amendment. And the Seventh Amendment is so de-emphasized and de-stressed. You know, one of the few areas left for juries is, you know, in these big personal injury cases, you know, where they come in and, you know, give these outrageous, you know, verdicts for, you know, $80 million and punitive damages and everything else. But in terms of developing, you know, common law, which in large part, when the people were making it through jury trials, could be traced to common sense and the Ten Commandments, particularly when we had a people that were committed to that. Tying back to James Madison, who said, hey, our idea of popular sovereignty has no chance without a people who are committed to the Ten Commandments as being a higher law. You know, that is something that has been absolutely, you know, destroyed and warped. And I think in many senses, the states are as guilty as the federal government for that, you know, kind of taking what was the tradition of common law being developed through juries and precedents at that level and turning into a, you know, government-made statutory law has really transformed, not in a good way, you know, our system.
Marty, would it be fair to say that one of the highest forms of exercising individual sovereignty would be when serving as a juror, whether a grand juror or a petit juror, where you would in fact ignore the opinion of law of the judge and apply, in essence, common law in your decision as a juror, because you have every right as a sovereign citizen of a state to exercise common law in your decision as a juror? Would that be a fair statement?
I believe it is. Red, how about yourself?
It's definitely because of the, again, going back to the pecking order, the sovereignty issue of the individual. We are sovereign over the Constitution and the government, and they're below us, both of them. Both the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the government, including the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government, they're all under us. We're only subject to God and His law, our Creator. Now, one thing that kind of confuses things for some people, I think, is the fact that we have so many corporations today, And people really don't understand the corporation as well as they should. The corporation is a creature and created by the state, by government. And you and I were created by a creator God. The corporation is created by, too many times, a small g God. And you and I, we were to function in the likeness of our Creator. In other words, we were to be honest, we were to be productive, we were to be creative, and all of that. The corporation is a person in the law business. They think of it as a person. And too many times, what happens in corporate court actions, there's no common law, see, applying in corporate law unless you've got somebody on a jury that recognizes a very clear-cut violation of common law. In the controversy between the corporations or between the corporation and government. The juror in a case, now see, you can't get common law jurisdiction in a controversy between a corporation or two corporations or a corporation and government. You can't, it just isn't available. The common law doesn't apply. But if you have a conflict where there is, you might say, some real shady dealing going on and one thing another, and you've got somebody on that jury that is very familiar with the common law, like thou shalt not steal and such, and they have the authority. They have the authority to make their findings as what they think it should be. And so there can be a little confusion there. But corporate cases are either admiralty jurisdiction or equity jurisdiction, one of the two. And, of course, they always are represented by attorneys. And so There's a certain amount of confusion there with people. They don't really grasp the difference. I'll digress just a bit here. I've used Enron Corporation as an example of a corporation operating in the likeness of their creator. Now, Martin, you've probably never heard anybody say that before.
I'm following the idea of Enron acting in the image of their creator. We know who their creator was.
Yeah, we know who their creator was. They lie, they steal, they cheat, they murder, they do everything. And Enron was just functioning in the likeness of their creator. And so that's something that we have to be watching for, alert to, out here in our world at our level. Go ahead.
Well, Ray, you know, I think we're getting to, and we've been talking around and in some of the critical points. I think, you know, I think I mentioned earlier, I think that our country maybe was set up and founded by people who understood that all legitimate law is traceable to the Ten Commandments, number one. Number two, the problem is that government has and always will try to redefine where our rights and sovereignty come from. Every other government in human history has basically said any rights that you, the people, have
are those that are accorded to you by government. And we all know that in our country, the sovereignty was acknowledged and recognized as coming from God. All our rights come from our Creator, and the only legitimate role of government is to secure those rights. That's the Declaration of Independence. Another thing our government and revisionists attempt to do is say that the Declaration of Independence is just some flowery document that states a lot of nice ideals, rather than it being an organic legal document, without which the colonies would not have become states, because that was the demarcation point where the colonies, former colonies, said, no, we are sovereign states because we have the authority and duty to throw away this illegitimate government that is no longer acting to simply secure our rights. So we are legitimately overthrowing it. It's our duty because our rights and our sovereignty come from God. So that's the starting point of everything. And what we get into, and we've been talking about the Ten Commandments and our Creator and so forth, what we get into is, as we see increasingly, and we will increasingly see, and it's happening so much in other countries like Canada and in Europe, where because the government has gotten to the point where they say, no, we define, we tell you what your rights are, what your fundamental rights are. We see these Supreme Court opinions saying it is a fundamental right accorded by the government through, and we are according through the Constitution, a fundamental right to privacy, a fundamental right to all types of crazy stuff. They try to redefine things. And now we are seeing and will continue to see that the government through the courts are going to say that proclaiming the gospel is not a right that the people have. That is, a hate crime, and it will be a jailable offense. And this is, to me, one of the maybe the primary reason why I am so motivated in this area of finding a way to deal with federal government encroachment, because that's the direction we're going in. And from my view, I look at Revelation 3. Behold, our Savior saying, behold, I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it. The Great Commission, publishing the gospel throughout all nations. Our country, the people who founded our country and our constitutional system, with the guarantees of free speech, a free exercise of religion, and a free enterprise system which allows us to develop the level of prosperity where we can carry out the Lord's Great Commission with unparalleled intensity, effectiveness, magnitude that has not been possible in human history, but through our country, that's an open door, and I think it's our responsibility to keep it open, or to endeavor to keep it open until our Lord shuts it. So that's the direction I see when we really drill down. It won't be long, the path we're on, and we look at what's happening in other countries, so-called free societies, where proclaiming the gospel is not a right, rather it's a crime. So I always like to bring that out because I see that as maybe the most important or critical component. I mean, it when we drill down to the essence of things, who is in charge, our Creator or government? We really see where that adversarial aspect of government versus what this country was founded on and why people came to this land in the first place.
I hate to mention it because I don't want to give them any ideas, but I've been waiting for the government to try to license preachers to remove it from a right to a privilege. I just want to mention, Martin, we've got about 11 minutes, 12 minutes at the most to go in the show, and I do want to give you a chance to talk a little bit about the 10th Amendment Center and give us an idea of what prompted you to get involved in that, what you see it accomplishing, and if it's something that people should be paying more attention to, getting involved in. It may be a way, I think, to maybe have a greater impact in your particular state. What do you have to say about that?
Yeah, no, thanks for the opportunity to speak on the 10th Amendment Center. The 10th Amendment Center is is an entity and an organization that I really found a great affinity for, because they stand for the proposition, the principles that, you know, that I have found have resonated with me so much. The idea that, you know, hey, 10th Amendment Center, the idea that, you know, all power, all sovereignty, anything that's not specifically delegated to the federal government is reserved to the states and their people, respectively, the respective states and their people. And that accordingly, as Jefferson and Madison said way back in 1798, you know, we, the people of our states, you know, the authority and the sovereignty of we, the people, of me here in New Jersey, of you all out there in Colorado and Montana, our listeners, how do we exercise our sovereignty? Well, the only real means or instrumentality of doing it is through our state governments. You know, everything we do through our state governments. I mean, the states individually assented to the Constitution and joined the Union, and they can individually withdraw. And, you know, any authority and powers that are reserved to us are reserved for our exercise through and at our state levels, through our elected representatives. So that concept and the idea of nullification and resistance at the state level is what the 10th Amendment Center is all about, education and actual encouragement and work with not just the people of the states, but also with their elected representatives to, you know, take bold and appropriate action to resist and nullify. There are a number of nullification conferences that are ongoing and will continue to go on in various parts of our country over the next months via the 10th Amendment Center. By the way, it's easy to find anything you want to know about the 10th Amendment Center by going to 10th Amendment Center, spelling out 10thAmendmentCenter.com. There you can find the individual state chapters, you know, for those of you looking for something, you know, directly in your state. As you mentioned, Terry, I'm the coordinator for New Jersey. But this is a wonderful organization founded by Michael Bolden. And I kept hearing about the 10th Amendment Center, so I knew they were probably having some effectiveness. One of the fellows who really has noticed the permeation of the 10th Amendment Center's activities and raising the consciousness of the people on in this area is a fellow, a friend and colleague, Tom Woods, who is with the Mises Institute, and he has just published a book called Nullification, you know, speaking to these same principles. And, you know, so I just thought this organization was one that would provide a tremendous forum using the Internet, using the great tool and power of the Internet, and also of localized conferences and speakers and so forth to assert these principles surrounding, you know, what the 10th Amendment is all about and the, you know, process of nullification. And maybe read at some point, we can organize a 7th Amendment Center as well, but that's what the 10th Amendment Center is all about. And I'm proud to be a part of it. I encourage everyone listening tonight to pull up 10thAmendmentCenter.com and see what it's all about, see if it's something you'd like to get involved in and participate in.
Well, thank you, Martin. I really, really appreciate you coming tonight. Red, we've got about 6 minutes. Do you have anything else for Martin?
You remember, it was about a year ago we had Steve Pigeon on our program, if you remember.
Yes.
And he made the comment that he didn't anticipate our federal government, you know, being able to stay in power. In fact, he was saying that it could go down in a matter of a few short months. But you know, I've told this before. About 25 years or so ago, I went to the county courthouse and I read the complete Supreme Court decision, 1963, when the U.S. Supreme Court took the Bible out of the classroom. I read the complete decision. There's a lot of verbiage there, but I read it all. And when I walked out of that courthouse that day, I knew that our federal government at some point was going to be dissolved. And because our federal government is in violation of the First Commandment, it has become a false god, and it is trying to put the true God down out of sight someplace. And so the First and Second Commandments are still the law, and that God has ordained and approved. And so we're looking at some very serious times ahead of us. It didn't happen as quick as Steve said, but I still believe that the federal government is going to be dissolved. And I had written it in one of my books about the USSR and what brought down the USSR. It wasn't Reaganomics or Reagan saying, bring down this wall or anything else. It was the fact that God is a jealous God, and he does not share his glory with anybody, and he doesn't like false gods. And so we want to keep this in mind, that the federal government that we know of today is in violation of God's law. And God is going to crack the whip one of these days at some point, and just how it's going to happen, I don't know. But the more of us that have accumulated the information that we have talked about here tonight, the better we will be able to perhaps pick up the pieces. And you know, there'll be those who want to get rid of the Constitution and all, and come up with a different form of government. But we need to really strengthen our commitment to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and be available as leadership when this judgment comes down on our government that we have today. And with that, I want to thank Martin for being here, because I think this has been one of the one program that's gone 2 hours, has gone very, very rapidly. And I sure appreciate the fact, and perhaps we can entice him to come back and join us for more. So it's back to you, Terry.
Thank you, Rick. You know, Terry, I know we're running short, but if I could have 30 seconds to follow up on what Red said as we close. Do we have the time
for that? You have 2.5 minutes.
Well, I'll take less than that, but I do want to thank both of you. And, Red, it's a privilege to be on with you particularly, and Terry as well, and I'd be privileged to be back at some point in the future if you'll have me. But to close things and follow up on what Red just said, you know, a few years back, you may remember Judge Roy Moore, they called him the Ten Commandments Judge, posted the Ten Commandments in his courtroom in Alabama. The federal court essentially said, and there's a lot of dirty pool there, the Attorney General in Alabama received a federal judicial appointment from President George W. Bush and turncoat on Judge Moore. But putting all that aside, the federal courts at two levels said in no uncertain terms, the acknowledgement of God is unconstitutional. And you know, so when you look at this and the idea that the federal government, in its desire for power, any entity or institution that tries to make itself above God or, you know, is going to deny God. And that's exactly what's happening here. But as I mentioned, you know, Revelation 3, there is an open door. No one, including the federal government, can shut it. So as they continue to attempt to shut it, I agree with Red, something's got to give, and it certainly won't be our Lord. So it's going to be interesting to see how all this shakes out as we go forward in these perilous times. But I do thank you both for having me on tonight.
Well, Martin, I'll tell you, one of the ways we tell how good a show is how fast it seems to go by. And it just seems like we've been talking for 20 minutes instead of 2 hours. And I attribute that to you, because you have been a great guest tonight, and we definitely want you to come back, please. And I will stay in touch. I want to learn more about the 10th Amendment, sir. I really do. And we need to do that off the air, as well as maybe coming back on and talking more about that here. But time is up for tonight, and we just thank God for being with us and His Spirit filling this show, because if it wasn't for Him, we wouldn't be here. And same for our guests. We've had a lot of listeners tonight, and it's been a great chat tonight. Fred, thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks, Barry.
You
may
like to gamble. Night, Red. You might like to dance. Good night, everyone. You may be the heavyweight champion. This is one of my favorite songs. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're going to have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're going to have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. Maybe a rock and roll addict dancing on the stage. Money, drugs at your command, women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor, or they may call you chief. Gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Somebody.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Somebody.
You may be a state trooper. It may be a young Turk. Maybe the head of some bigger TV network. Rich or poor, you may be blind or lame, maybe living in another country under another name, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Living in a mansion, you might live in a dome. You may own guns and you may even own tanks. You may be somebody's landlord, you may even own banks. But you're gonna have to sell somebody. Yeah, you're gonna have to sell somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
You may be a preacher, spiritual pride. Maybe a city councilman taking bribes on the side. Maybe working in a barber shop, you may know how to cut hair. And maybe somebody's mistress, maybe somebody's heir. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Might like to wear cotton, might like to wear silk, might like to drink whiskey, might like to drink milk. Might like to eat caviar, you might like to eat bread. Maybe sleeping on the floor, sleeping in a king-size bed. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Bobby, or you may call me Zimmy, you may call me RJ, you may call me Ray, you may call me anything, no matter what you say.